Chapter 1, For Heroic Spirits Intended. Homage to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, thereupon the Lord, in order to gladden the four assemblies, and to further lighten up this perfection of wisdom, preached at that time the following verses. Already we know that we are in the presence of a Mahayana Sutra, if only because the homage is addressed to Bodhisattvas in the plural. The Theravadins revere only one Bodhisattva, Maitreya. There is, however, another fairly clear indication in this short prelude to the main text that this is not only a Mahayana Sutra, but quite an early one. This clue lies in the audience, the four assemblies, the Katavarga, the original subdivisions within the Mahasangha, bhikshus, bhikshunis, upasakas, and upasikas. That is, monks, nuns, male lay followers, and female lay followers. Whoever adopted this term Katavarga, probably, though I do not know whether this has occurred to anyone else, intended a parallel with the Brahminical Katavarna, the four colours, or as we would say, the four castes of Brahminical society, the Brahmin, the Kshatriya, the Vaishya, and the Shudra, that is, priests, aristocrats, merchants, and labourers. The parallel would be meant presumably to highlight the principle of division in each case, the Katavarna obviously dividing society according to inherited caste, while the Katavarga divides the Sangha according to sex and lifestyle. The audience here, then, is a very straightforward representation of the spiritual community. Later sutras were at pains to exercise a more open admissions policy to the Mahasangha, and the congregation became, in these works, altogether more colourful, including not only bodhisattvas and arhats, but also devas, nagas, gandharvas, and even animals, representatives, in fact, of all the different classes of living beings. But in this sutra, one's imagination does not get stretched in this way, and this helps to identify it as an early Mahayana work. Once it has established who is present, the sutra wastes no time in setting out the Buddha's purpose in preaching, an unfortunate translation, these verses. And his purpose is firstly to gladden the four assemblies, to give them a special treat. Instead of sila or samadhi, they're getting pranya. They're getting, indeed, pranya paramita. Though not, it would seem, for the first time, because the Buddha is going to further illuminate the perfection of wisdom. Preliminary admonition. Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements, and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the weal of the world, for heroic spirits intended. The translator's heading is apt. Here is a cautionary word of advice. Reflect on the emotional attitude you are bringing to this sutra. If the Buddha's first aim is to awaken a joyous emotional response, then we need to think again about our whole approach to the perfection of wisdom. It is not good enough, if we do not understand it, to assume that we are just not up to it intellectually. The first thing the Buddha asks is not, I hope you have your wits about you, or do you have a degree in philosophy, but are you emotionally positive? Are you receptive to the Dharma? And are you allowing this positivity and receptivity to develop without limitation? The expression call forth, after all, suggests that we are to bring out something that is already there. The love, the respect, and the faith are all there, latent within us. They're natural human endowments. It is as though the Buddha is saying, let them express themselves, let them manifest themselves. They are there, and they are the appropriate emotions to bring to the perfection of wisdom. So don't place any limitation on them by imagining that you have to start laboriously manufacturing them. You are better than you think you are. This idea, fundamental to Buddhism, is one that goes against the grain for those of us who imagine that our socialized selves are sitting on a lot of unattractive, basic animal urges, and that if we become less inhibited, all sorts of unpleasant negative emotions are going to come pouring out. But that is a one-sided view of things. There is a lot that is good and positive that also gets repressed. In a largely secular society, this is perhaps especially true of devotional feelings. If you no longer believe in the Blessed Virgin Mary, for example, you cannot even offer so much as a candle in a church, and in this way your love and reverence and faith remain unused and stifled. You may even come to the conclusion that you simply have no devotional feelings. I have known a lot of apparently quite intellectual people who, while they used to find the devotional demands of Christianity quite suffocating, nevertheless discovered, when they eventually took up Buddhist devotional practices, that they enjoyed being devotional. They found, rather to their surprise, that they really rather enjoyed offering flowers and lighting candles, that it was in fact quite a relief to be able to do so at last. So, call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Yes, clear them away, but do so on the basis of developing positive emotions and removing whatever stops them arising. Remove whatever it is that obstructs the arising of insight and clarity of vision, the development of positive, perfect wisdom. The 10 kleshas, or defilements, and the 3 asavas, or biases, towards sensuous experience, conditioned existence, and speculative opinions, must be removed, because they obstruct energy. Indeed, they also misuse energy. They cause it to leak away. They squander it. They waste the energy you need if you are to adopt an attitude of perfect receptivity to the perfection of wisdom. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas. This may come as a bit of a surprise. Surely we are about to receive a very strong teaching here, the ultimate teaching, in fact. Surely it should be trumpeted forth in a voice like thunder. Why the gentle Buddhas? Well, strangely enough, spiritual power bears no relation to anything we would recognize as potency. This is demonstrated in the Bible, in the well-known passage in Kings 1, in which God pays a visit to the prophet Elijah. Quote, "And a great and strong wind rent the mountains, and break in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice." Elijah recognizes this as the voice of the Lord and goes out to meet him. The perfection of wisdom does not call for physical power. It does not express itself in a lot of psychophysical energy. It has nothing to do even with intellectual power. It is something of an entirely different character. For a parallel to this, consider the way mantras are chanted. The Tara mantra, Om Tare Tutare Ture Swaha, is recited softly, but that does not make it weaker than the Padmasambhava mantra, Om Mahung Jatsanguru Padma Siddhi Hung, which is usually recited more loudly, although it is really a mistake to think that you can express the spiritual vigour of the Padmasambhava mantra by shouting and roaring. In the Vajracchedika Pranayaparamita Sutra, we are given the perfection of wisdom that cuts like a diamond. Han Shan, the Zen master, called it the diamond cutter of doubts, representing perfect wisdom in its function of cutting through all doubts like a vajra. In the Diamond Sutra, perfection wisdom, perfect wisdom is powerful, thrusting, and effective. Don't imagine, however, that you're going to get a great, powerful blast from the Ratnaguna Samchagatha. Here, perfect wisdom comes softly, gently, unobtrusively. It does not come by way of a great upheaval from the depths, nor does it descend cataclysmically from the heights. Rather, it seems to come sideways, obliquely, indirectly. You don't quite notice which direction it's come from at all, just that it's there. It is little wonder that when the Prajnaparamita became embodied as a bodhisattva, it should have appeared in female form. The perfection of wisdom is subtle and elusive. It evades your grasp. You can't quite get hold of it. Thinking about it rationally is as useless as it would be for a man to try and understand a woman, and this is to speak traditionally, even mythically, by taking a course in logic. The only real chance you have lies in the non-rational, devotional approach. Of course, the logical corollary of this idea would be to suggest that women should be more capable of grasping, or rather of not grasping, the perfection of wisdom than men. But this is the literal, so-called masculine mind at work again. Logic simply does not apply here. To avoid further misunderstandings, let us briefly unpack this whole parcel of male prejudice towards the female mind. Certainly women can be frustrated when their deep-rooted desires are not satisfied, but that has nothing to do with being irrational. Women only appear to men to be irrational when men ignore or fail to acknowledge these deep motivations. In fact, everybody is irrational, nobody is guided by objective logical considerations. If anything, women are more practical and less irrational than men, in that they are less likely to disguise their irrationality beneath the layer of rationalization. My own experience is that men tend to fly off as a tangent and react in a highly emotional way, rather more than women do. The elusiveness of woman is, more simply, a symbol. It retains its symbolic value, even when we look a little more deeply at this fabled feminine elusiveness, when we recognize that, from the point of view of the male psyche, the feminine is ungraspable because it isn't out there to be grasped at all. In the same way, from the female angle, the masculine is not really out there. You are attracted by a certain quality, which you call femininity or masculinity, which you think is out there and which you have to go in search of. But of course, it is actually a potential quality of your own, waiting to be developed. The same goes up to a point for the perfection of wisdom. It is not an intellectual object to be mastered. It is to be found and nourished, in a manner of speaking, within yourself. To go searching for it in any other way is like looking into a mirror and trying to catch hold of your own face. It is ungraspable, because it isn't an object standing apart from a subject, ready to be grasped by that subject. Intellectually, it has to be an object, because when you think at all, you make something an object. But looked at psychologically, it is a subject rather than object. Ultimately, we have to go beyond all this, beyond the psychological. At this metaphysical level, there is neither object nor subject. Perfect wisdom is beyond the subject-object distinction altogether. In fact, it is not something apart from the Buddha himself. It is not even something he has mastered. Perfect wisdom is the Buddha. The Buddha is perfect wisdom, as well as all the other paramitas. When a Buddha thinks, perfect wisdom comes into operation. If Prajnaparamita is said to be the Jinamata, the mother of the conquerors, it is in the sense that a Buddha comes into being through the arising of perfect wisdom. By the same token, perfect wisdom comes into being through the Buddha's communication of the content of his enlightenment. It is a circular relationship. Perfect wisdom seeds a Buddha generates perfect wisdom. Taught for the weal of the world, for heroic spirits intended. When the Buddha sent out his first 60 disciples, he told them to go forth and teach the spiritual life as he had made it known to them, to the common people, for their welfare and their happiness. So the sublime teaching of the perfection of wisdom is taught for no other purpose than this simple and straightforward one, to make everybody happy. Of course, you will only be happy if you are evolving, developing, moving forward, not if you are standing still and stagnating, and this means making demands on yourself. The demands made by the teaching of the perfection of wisdom are tremendous, and only to be met by a heroic spirit. This conquering spirit is that of the Bodhisattva, the ultimate practitioner of the perfection of wisdom, the hero of all the Mahayana Sutras. Brave, enterprising, resolute, adventurous, and pioneering, always taking initiative, always taking responsibility.